Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Lives lost and found in prison are the sound and substance of this radio hour. Chris Hedges is our guest with a book called Our Class, about a course you taught, Chris, at the famous Rahway State Prison in New Jersey, Hurricane Carter's prison once upon a time. We're talking about a break in your journalistic life that got you ordained finally as a Christian minister 30 years late. But for people who think about a coming decarceration of American life, there's fire and light here from real experience and from two of your talented Take Charge students, Boris Franklin and Lawrence Bell. For listeners who know Chris Hedges as a war correspondent and a war hater, for that book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, get us into the turn that took you to prison as a teacher, professor, and then as the creator of a prison theater company. Whose desperate idea was this? Under what rules of engagement? What were you getting into?
For me, there's a complete continuity in everything that I've done. As you know, I graduated from Harvard Divinity School, and while at Harvard, I lived across from the Mission Main Mission Extension Housing Project in Roxbury, and as a seminarian, ran a small church. I became increasingly disenchanted with, let's call them, the liberal elites, people who like the poor but don't like the smell of the poor, who talk about empowering people they never met. I was also by nature a writer and went from Harvard to El Salvador as a freelance reporter to cover the war there, where I was for 5 years. I ended up spending 20 years abroad, but always in places where people were living under great distress. I spent 7 years in the Middle East, much of that time in Gaza, covered the war in the former Yugoslavia, was in Sarajevo during the war and later Kosovo. These were not positions that were highly coveted, partly because they were dangerous. So when I came back to the United States, I think I gravitated quite naturally towards those who the great theologian James Cone calls the crucified of the earth. I stumbled into prison teaching through my good friend Celia Chazelle, the head of the history department of the College of New Jersey. That's how I went into the prison. In terms of this particular class, it was a kind of organic process. I had no intention when I went in there of having them write a play.
Your interest in divinity and journalism is not exactly new. Your friend and mine, Steve Kinzer, said, you're not really a journalist, Chris. You're a minister pretending to be a journalist. But how did the vocation turn to prison?
Because in the criminal caste system of America, these are the demonized. And remember, I was spending my life overseas with the demonized, the Palestinians. I covered the war in El Salvador during the Reagan administration, those who were resisting the brutal oligarchy and death squads that the United States had allied itself with. I also covered the war in Guatemala under Rios Montt and later the Sandinistas. We, as journalists, were regularly accused by the Reagan White House of being fifth columnists. So that was a community that I instinctively wanted to reach out to because throughout my life as a journalist, and Kinzer's right, but I just want to say that good preachers, like good journalists, care about the truth. And the news is different from the truth. As a journalist, I can take facts. A column, an article, a news article can be factually correct, but I can use those facts to spin it any way that you want. And if I spin it responsibly towards my reader, it is about imparting the truth. If I care about my career, you know there are plenty of careerists at the New York Times. They will spin it in such a way as Abe Rosenthal did when he reported on the police violence in Columbia in 1968 and focused on the destruction of the president's office. This created a kind of meteoric rise for him within the hierarchy. I think that that commonality is the truth. Kinzer's right about that.
Chris Hedges, when you went into that prison classroom, you set certain standards and rules of engagement, and you dressed in a certain way and spoke in a certain way. Explain what you were up to there.
Well, I'd been in prison long enough to understand that, especially those who are attracted to the courses, and this was very true at Rahway, these are what Gramsci calls organic intellectuals, people like Boris and Lawrence, incredibly gifted intellectually. they turn their cells into libraries. I was at the gate when Boris was released. I was with his mother and his daughter. And the first words out of Boris's mouth after 11 years of being incarcerated to me were, "I have to rebuild my library." Hmm. So here you have these incredibly gifted intellectuals, but they've never been given a chance within the dysfunctional school system. Both Boris and Lawrence will tell you, perhaps with some complaint, that I'm a very tough grader, but I hold them to those standards because they can meet them. So I expect the same kind of decorum that I expected in a Princeton. I've taught at Princeton, Columbia, a few other places, that I expect in those classrooms from top-tier universities. And I also dress that way. I always wore a suit. I did lay down the rules that here we respect everyone's ideas. There's no disrespect towards anyone based on race or gender. And there's deep homophobia in any prison, in male prisons. And so I was quite explicit about not using slurs towards homosexuals. Yes, I did walk in there and kind of lay down the law.
For people who haven't felt the routine humiliations of prison life, Chris Hedges, your Officer Watkins sets the scene early in the play. He's directing a strip search of a new arrival at Rahway before 5 or 10 others who are all in shackles. Boris Franklin wrote the part of Officer Watkins, and he speaks it here.
"My name is Officer Watkins. This is Officer Watkins' prison. What Officer Watkins say in Officer Watkins' prison goes. Next, Officer Watkins will do a visible inspection of your complete person. Open your mouth wide. Stick out your tongue. Lift up your top lip. Pull your bottom lip down. Lift your arm straight out in the air so I can see your armpits. Bend your right ear. Bend your left ear. Fingers through your hair. Lift your piece. Lift your nutsack. Turn around. Lift your right foot. Lift your left foot. Bend over. Spread your cheeks and cough. Okay, get dressed. Walk to the end of the hallway. Face the wall and don't talk."
What did it feel like to be in there, Chris?
People have often asked. I always felt very comfortable in there. Maybe it's because I came out of war zones and was familiar with the culture of violence. And let's talk about the trauma. I myself bear trauma from covering war for as long as I did. So I felt completely comfortable in that space. You know, I have now a very close relationship with many of my former students, including Lawrence and Boris, who you'll talk to later. And they remind me of war correspondents. Hmm. Incredibly bright, incredibly articulate, but they know the world. They're also fiercely loyal in the way that if you cover a war, you never leave anyone behind. And of course, there were moments in firefights where my stomach was falling to the floor, but you just don't leave until you all leave. Mm. And that's a quality they have. I never felt any discomfort at all. In fact, I found a kind of familiarity inside the prison that I don't find in Princeton where I live.
Wow. You remind me of a point that I'd almost forgotten, that most of the prisoners you see in that prison took a plea. They didn't go before a jury. They took a lesser sentence for fear of getting a worse one at trial. But most of them are second-guessing themselves all the time about that.
Yes, most 94% of the people in our prison system were coerced, and I use that word quite consciously, coerced into taking a plea. And the way they do it, the way they did it with Boris, is they stack all sorts of charges against you. And I think the prosecutor knows very well as the police, that you didn't commit it. But if you go to court, you have to face all of those charges. So the plea deal is we drop this, we drop that, we drop kidnapping, which I think is 25 years. And the people that I taught with the longest sentences are the, like Lawrence, who was charged at the age of 14 as an adult and then wasn't eligible to go before a parole board until he was 70 years old. He's out because we had a wonderful lawyer, Jennifer Sinetti, in a resentencing hearing. But they got the longest sentences because the system would crash if everyone had a jury trial. It's not designed to carry out jury trials. And so those who go to trial, and unfortunately, those are the people who often did not commit the crime, although many of those who take a plea didn't commit the crime, and they think that they're going to be found innocent because they are innocent. Instead, they're given much longer sentences to be made an example of.
You opened this course teaching The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. And it becomes one of the wonderful turning points in this whole story. The guys didn't want to read Michelle Alexander, and they didn't want to hear about New Jim Crow. They probably knew the whole story. But there comes a moment when you all seem to decide together, wouldn't it be interesting just to write what we're living, to write it down, to phrase it well, to do fragments of stories, memoirs, what turned out to be a play. Describe how Michelle Alexander left the curriculum and August Wilson, the playwright, walked in.
So I was always going to teach August Wilson and Panera and McCraney and others, but I do like the new Jim Crow because many people think that it's just them and their friends. And I think Michelle Alexander does a good job of explaining that it's the entire system, that's the way it's designed. But that is an academic read. You're exactly right. I dragged one class through Sheldon Wolin's Politics and Vision. They all bear the scars to this day. But something happened with the drama. And what happened was one of the students, his nickname is Kabir, which in Arabic means big, and he's big, had heard me on WBAI and had recruited the best writers in the prison, which include Boris and Lawrence. When I found out in that first class that people really didn't have much familiarity with dramatic dialogue, I decided, just on a whim, it wasn't premeditated, well, why don't you write scenes about your life? Because writing drama is about conveying emotions, information, and experiences through dialogue. And when I got those first scenes, 28 students brought the papers home, all handwritten, and it has that musty smell from the prison, I just hit on several of them, absolute gold, which is almost anything Boris or Lawrence wrote. And this happened after a couple weeks. And my wife is an actor, professional actor, went to Juilliard. And I showed them to her. And I said, I'm going to see if we can put this all together and write a play. But I needed more time. You can get an extra session each week in the prison by signing up those students in the class who need remedial help. And without asking permission, I signed up the entire class for remedial help, so I got an extra night. That's how we embarked on this amazing process, but it was completely unplanned. And suddenly people were speaking in these scenes that they had written about deeply emotional. I mean, there were some students who couldn't even read what they'd written, deeply emotional and powerful moments in their lives that they'd never shared with anyone else in the prison. And that just broke down these walls. There's a deep protective layer that people build around themselves emotionally in order to survive in prison.
Coming up, Boris Franklin and Lawrence Bell, and the view from the other side of that invisible wall. You know they got me trapped in this prison of seclusion. Happiness living on the streets is a delusion. Even a smooth criminal one day must get... This is Open Source. Chris Hedges, I'd like you to introduce two of your star students at Rahway Prison, Boris Franklin and Lawrence Bell, and I want to get their impressions from day one of their new teacher in his Brooks Brothers suit. Take us back to the beginning. You walk into that classroom, and there's this big fellow sitting in the back looking you over very studiously. What did you make of him? What did you know about him?
It was immediately apparent that he, Boris, just had tremendous gravitas. I mean, you felt that the moment you were in their presence. And in some ways, I guess, consciously knew I had to win them over. And if I didn't win them over, I wasn't going to win anyone over.
Boris, you wrote to Chris later, I watched you that first day. What were you seeing? The man in the Brooks Brothers suit and all that New York Times history.
The thing that won me over was his ability to be tough in a very aggressive space. I mean, he came in and he laid down the law, and I knew that he was going out on what he said. You say, you're going out on your shield. That means if I say I'm not going to tolerate something, I'm not going to tolerate it. And that means that I'm prepared to stand my ground on it. And when he came into a space where you had a bunch of individuals who had been cast as hardened criminals, almost everyone in the classroom is locked up for a homicide or something, and he didn't flinch one bit. He said, this is going to be the culture of this class, and this is how we're going to proceed. And that was the end of it. So first thing he won was my respect, why even was begin to respect him as a writer or academic or anything else. He won my respect as a human being.
You won my attention, Boris, when you wrote afterward a wonderful description of that whole scene, including the line that caught my eye, the most powerful prisoners are not the gangsters. They are those who have earned the respect of other prisoners and the guards. How many guys do that, and how do they do it?
So it depends on basically your talent, your personal talents. Some guys have different ways of earning respect. Mine was through my words, you know?
if I could get a guard in a one-on-one space and we're having a conversation, he's going to understand that I can match wits with him, right? And he's going to understand that he can't get me into one of his sweet spots where he could say, okay, this prisoner was being belligerent or this prisoner was being extremely disrespectful. I know exactly how he's going to write his charge up. And when it comes to the other inmates, they have to understand that I'm prepared to go as far as they're prepared to go. I'm prepared to match their level of intensity. Despite the fact that I might sit here and I'm going to read my books and I'm not going to bother anybody, but they have to understand it's a very physical space. It's an aggressive space.
Boris, you spoke about the men in what you call Rahway University, including this class, as serious guys. You said we had converted ourselves into libraries. Our books were our most precious possessions, especially since we had to scrape together the money to buy them. We did not lend them unless we were sure they would be read and even sure that they would be returned. And if you read one of our books, you had better be prepared to give an intelligent commentary on its contents. We were a dedicated fraternity of prison scholars. By the end, you said, my class contained highly literate men. None of this was apparent from looking at most of them, but their passions and mine were identical. I was not, I would soon find out, the only writer in the room.
There were plenty of guys like Lawrence, and I was a guy who read, and I thought I was pretty smart. I was completely intimidated by some of these guys, how much they had read, because you know, I had been in prison for 11 years. Some of these guys have been reading one subject, one discipline for 20 years. So when I came in and I went to these guys, like, can I read that book? They very quickly showed me that this is not an easy club to get into.
Lawrence Bell, were you one of those guys who intimidated your friend Boris?
Not to my knowledge, but he's a pretty big guy. He's kind of hard to intimidate. But I was definitely one of the guys that had done some reading prior to the class.
What did you make of Chris Hedges? And come to the high points in this course you took.
Well, I remember early in the class, I just kind of sat back and just watched him. More than watched, kind of listened to what he said. You know, he gave us a little bit of his background, being a war correspondent. He told us about being captured and things like that. For me, it eased me into accepting the things that he said because I knew on some level he related to what we were going through on a daily basis, right? The everyday life of the carceral space, like the oppression, the despair, these things that most often people don't talk about, he wore it on him. When he spoke about it, you could feel it coming from inside of him. It wasn't somebody just coming here. You know, we had had professors in the past that, you know, unfortunately that they were there because this is where they were getting a check from, or this is because, you know, people were going for their doctorates and they had to do their internships or whatever the case may be. But it was immediately different. I recall exactly the conversation that Boris refers to when he came in and established the ground rules. I consider myself like a quasi-intellectual. So for me, just the fact that he spoke with authority, but an authority that was steeped in his knowledge base, it automatically made me like, okay, I can't play with this one. I have to really, really assert myself in this one. High point in the class for me, when I think about it now, it was kind of the freedom that I gained in finally being able to tell people my story, right? Because prior to this, for 20 years, no one really knew who I was or what circumstances that brought me into prison or how young I was or what it was like for me being in that space as a child. And it was the first time that I had gained the autonomy and the safety of my brothers to be able to say, hey, this is what it really is.
Do you remember the transition that jumps out of the book from Michelle Alexander in The New Jim Crow to August Wilson, the playwright of Fences and many more? I've seen most of his plays, but I was unprepared for the power of lines that were, in effect, quoted to you, taught to you in prison about writing, that you've got to confront the dark parts, and that most of us non-playwrights have forgot our power to sing. What stuck for you from August Wilson?
Oh, I think particularly from Fences was the scene where the young man challenges his father, right? It's almost like he's taking on a dichotomous role of, I have to, in this space, allow him to be a man, but I also have to assert my parenthood over him. And in some ways, I think that for me, that was the play out of the class, right? In that Chris was there, and yes, he had to allow us to assert ourselves and to be ourselves and to express ourselves, but he also had to be the guider. He had to be the shepherd to lead us through it. Watching that play out, it was like reading Fences and watching it play out on a different term at the same time.
Wow, there's a lot of that father and son stuff. Guys in prison realizing that they, some of them have disappointed their fathers, some have lived their father's lives all over again. One guy in the book who's desperately burdened by his father's past suddenly realizes he's in the same prison cell that his father had occupied.
Well, for me, the idea of fathers and sons is actually pretty salient because I don't have a father. I've never known my father, and the only person that I ever known to be a quote-unquote father figure is the person that brought about my mother's demise. So I didn't identify with any male figures. I didn't know what a real positive male role model or father figure looked like. So for me, I found a lot of my fatherhood figures in books. You know, one of my favorite books is Man, Child, and the Promised Land by Claude Brown. And it's his autobiographical novel. But for me in the class, you know, I'm not ashamed to say like Chris has become more than just a professor to me or a teacher to me. He's become my mentor, my friend, and the closest thing to a father figure that I've ever known in my life. So for me, that was the idea or the role of fatherhood played out differently than it probably did for most of the guys in the class.
In the book, Boris, Chris Hedges asks you, why is this song, this truth that August Wilson says is so vital, why is it so difficult to sing? And your answer was, because of the pain. Explain that.
Anytime you want to go into something like that, you have to go to a dark space. Even when I have to write, I have to revisit some things and draw from that moment, right, in order to sing that song. And the song that you're singing, if you could put it in any genre, it's mostly the blues, right? It's going to be a very heartbreaking song. That's what part of telling your story is. You have to go into that space because you want to tell the whole story. You know, when Lawrence finally says, one day I said, this is what happened to me. Now he's telling his story or he's singing his song, right? To go there and to let all that playing out, you spend your whole life avoiding it. I mean, your first years of life, if you come from where I come from, is just extremely painful. It's just loss and disappointment, more loss and disappointment, more loss and disappointment. Mm. And then you block it off and you create something to be a buffer between you and the world. And now you're asking somebody to go into that space and to pull that out and to still be a man. And that makes it problematic because we have this social construct as a man to not be able to cry and so many other things. So it's a very difficult space to revisit to go get the lyrics of those songs.
Chris Hedges, would you speak of another wonderful turning point in your telling of the story? It's when somebody realizes that art, transcendence, poetry, music, the power of the sacred, all sort of exotic elements of our conversation have got to be part of this course. You speak of it as all these things, the music especially, what Ralph Ellison said black people had in place of freedom, but you were rediscovering it in a new way there.
Well, I think theater, I mean, like all art, but theater does this really well. Number one, it's about, and August Wilson, that's why I admire him so much as a playwright, it's about lifting up the voices of your ancestors. And if you don't know your ancestors, you can't find out who you are. You can't, in Joe Turner Come and Gone, you can't find your song, which is what the play is about finding your song. And in order to be a complete person and in order to know yourself, that means getting in touch with all of these non-rational, not irrational, non-rational elements that go into making a full human being. Beauty, truth, grief, the search for a life of meaning, the struggle with our own mortality. That's what the Buddhists say. You can memorize as many sutras as you want. It will never make you wise. And that's what this play and the other plays that we read gave us. It gave the people in the class this ability to rip down these emotional walls and speak about their past. And I remember a comment Boris once said. He said, by the end of that class, we realized that we all had one story. It had different variations. As poor, primarily black people in America, we had one story. But that wasn't evident until everyone told their story.
What is that story? And aren't you sort of trampling on a lot of exotic individuality in our stories, Boris?
Well, for me, that one story is it's very hard being black in America. I mean, we all realize that. For African American here, to self-actualize is a challenge, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to just live life assertively is a challenge. Other citizens could just walk without having the same worries that we might have. Certain things that you think you have access to, the more and more you try to assert yourself and further you try to go, you start to see that being black is problematic in America, right? And we all realize that. It's extremely hard being a black person in America. There are landmines everywhere. You have to weigh your words properly. Even so much as picking out a garment, right? When we see the Trayvon Martin, a hoodie is something different for a young black male. If I see, you know, Lawrence Bell in a baseball cap, if it's a young kid in an urban space, it's looked at as sort of like that's thug clothing, right? But it's sports paraphernalia when I see young white kids, that must be their favorite team.
Lawrence Bell, what's your version of the one story?
My version of the story pretty much dovetails with what Boris is saying, is that being a young black man in this country is a struggle. The example that he gave kind of makes the point. These are the things that we look to change in terms of the individuality, you know, and the individual stories being lost or being muddled by this. The reality is that they're not, because it's kind of like reading a stream of consciousness book where there's four different people operating in the same space, having different thoughts, right? All of us are going through and experiencing the same things in different ways. And the way that I express it might be different from the way that Boris expresses it. But when you get down to the root core element of what it is that we're dealing with and what it is that we're saying, the lyrics don't change. It's the same song. Sometimes the beat is a little faster, sometimes it's a little slower.
In the book, Boris and Lawrence, you both tell extraordinarily painful, difficult, fascinating stories of your growing up. Can you give us a version, the short form, so to speak, of that story of your life, your father, Boris, drugs, dealing, prison, family, as you do in the book? What was the Boris story?
Well, my story was one of a complete surprise. You know, I started school, so I was born in New Brunswick, but my eyes opened to Piscataway, you know, very quickly. It was a nice, pristine suburban space. And then my father became addicted to heroin, and we moved into a place of extreme poverty. So it was a world I was unfamiliar with. And when I got there, all of the values in that other community were no longer valuable here. So I didn't really have value in this space when I first got there. And having an education wasn't valuable. It was a very physical space. And can you fight? Can you maneuver in an underground economy? All of these things became valuable. And I didn't have the skills to start with. I didn't have the instincts. And for every misstep I made, I had to pay for it in a very physical way, even with my father. You know, he was a very physical guy. So it was very sad for me in the first couple of years of my life. I spent almost, you know, just depressed until I became angry. And angry became an antidote for that level of depression. And in fact, it became a friend for me. And that's how I carried myself after that. I just became as aggressive as that community. And then I began to feel safe. I didn't feel so attacked. I didn't feel so oppressed. I wasn't so afraid, because more people were afraid of me than I was afraid of them. Mm-hmm. And one way not to be scared is to be the most feared person in the room.
One of the hardest stories in the book is your story of your son, Keon. Can you share it?
Yes, I had abandoned him and left him in a world by going to prison. I left him in a world that was going to do the same thing to him that they did to me, right? A world that was going to emotionally drain him to the point that he had to find some sort of persona to be a buffer against that world. And I had to watch it, knowing that it was going to happen. I knew that that world would eat him up. I knew that he would find out the things that I find out. I knew his heart would be broken, he would be sad, and he would eventually become angry. And he wound up in prison, just as I did. The only unfortunate thing was he actually died in prison in a fistfight in a cell. And it was something that, you know, I was even glad that my father had died before I went to prison, because I knew it would have broke his heart. And that's the thing, is that with most young men in those inner cities, they're just trying to keep them out of prison. The goal for young men is you just don't want them to wind up in prison. That's all you could hope for at that point. You don't want them to be, I didn't want them a good job or nothing. The hierarchy of needs, I just wanted them safe. Mm. And I couldn't protect him because I was in prison.
If you had to do it again, would it have to end that way?
It wouldn't have to end that way. And it's a very imaginary question. That's the throw off. We live in a world of realities. I can't do it again. And I knew that, you know, that was probably going to be the only ending for him, was either prison or an accelerated death. And everyone knew that that was going to be my reality. People could look and say, that kid's going to prison. That is the reality for young black men. You know, parents, single mothers, they try to keep their sons safe. You just don't want them to get hurt. You don't want them to wind up in prison. That is the major goal for young African-American men below the poverty line. You don't want them to wind up in prison. Because first of all, they live in an economy or society that has boxed them out of livable wages. So the only thing available sometimes is the underground economy. And that's where you're going to find your most interaction with the police and your most interaction with violence. It's just it. It's nothing else there. It's what I've heard commonly called is opportunity deserts. There's nothing else there.
What's changed since your son Keon's growing up?
Well, things get increasingly worse. Right now, the violence is high. When I was coming up, it was less violence and more drugs, right? But as you pull back on the drugs and there's no economy, that underground economy, which allows some guys to pay a bill or something, there's just more violence, right? So the drug trade is kind of gone and it's just violence left now. And you see this over the years because I have to have this conversation where if you look at the 80s, right, some of the same conversations we're having today, they were having in the 80s about gang violence. And it might change from California to New Jersey, but it's all the same world. But if you could say what was different today, it's a lot more violent. He grew up in a world of violence that was more violent than the world I grew up in.
Coming up, hearing your own voice for the first time spoken in a play you wrote. This is Open Source. The students in Chris Hedges' class at Rahway State Prison produced a powerful play in part because they had stories of their own to get out. Lawrence Bell, you came into prison at the age of 14, 30-some years ago. Prison has been your life. How did all this happen? How did your incredible, Chris Hedges calls it a train wreck of a life, come to be?
I come from one of the poorest cities on the East Coast, Camden, New Jersey, and I just come from a broken home. I lost my father before I was 2 years old, my mother at 9 years old. I came to be homeless by the time I was 12 years old, living in an abandoned house, 14 different addresses by the age of 14. So I never knew a sense of stability. I never knew a sense of family, of home, of mentorship or leadership. And for me, life was just hard every day. I lived in fear. I lived in solitude. I lived in myself. But the saddest part about it is that because this was all I knew, it became normal. It wasn't until I got around some other people that I realized how bad I actually had it. I think I just internalized what it was. And these are all of the elements that will lead a young man to prison.
Your stepfather, Reggie, was a nightmare. But the even more striking thing in the book is that nobody in the way of a public service agency intervened on your behalf. They seemed not to know you lived.
There's been numerous points in my life where I've asked myself how different my life would have been if someone had noticed. How do you take a 12-year-old out of school and I never get picked up by a truant officer? How does my mother die with her head in my lap and I never see a counselor or a psychologist or anything like that? These are systemic failures, particularly in these poor and underserved communities. This was the reality for so many of us. And I can say we're still in a space where our children are out there literally dying from violence and from a lack of care from us as a community, from the powers that be, the power structures. We're in a bad space still.
One of my favorite lines in this book is yours, Lawrence, at the point you're getting out of prison, finally. You say, it's bittersweet. A lot of these guys I grew up with, they're my brothers. They're not just my friends. As happy as I am to be leaving, I won't ever forget the fact that I am leaving people I love and care for behind. I believe you.
Me leaving them behind, like, I still suffer with it. I still, at times, I feel guilty for being free, knowing that some of these guys who are, I believe, some of the best people in the world are still incarcerated. It's a hard reality, but it's also a reality that I think pushes myself and Boris and others like me to do the work that we do to, one, bring them home, and two, to make that transition as easy for them or as seamless as possible for them when they do get out.
How practically do you do that, Lawrence? I'm fascinated to hear from you too, Boris. What can be done to get more people out, but also to meet them at the bus stop, to be prepared with a job, to be prepared with housing, to be prepared with a network of friends. What we call the prison to street pipeline.
The first thing is showing just the minimum of care, right? And that's the thing that people always forget about. There's a program that I'm involved with that Boris participates in. It's called Meet Him at the Gate. And it's based on a notion of, you know, in biblical times when people committed a crime, they were exiled. And at the conclusion of their exile, when they came back into their communities, there was a celebration or a jubilee. And this is what we're trying to embody when our brothers are coming out of prison. We all gather our resources, we gather our networks, we gather everything that we can. And when they walk out of that prison, they walk out into the embrace of a community. And the reason that we do this is so guys are coming home and walking into good jobs, steady jobs, stable jobs. And we're trying to grow this. We're trying to lead by example, by performing well. We all understand that we create a lane for someone else.
Over to you, Boris.
You know, I had that survivor's guilt as well. And what I did was I made myself agreeable to the pain, but I also made myself agreeable to changing some things. With guys like Lawrence, we have a laundry list of guys who came out of that prison, who felt with that pain, who dealt with that pain, and we're not letting it go. It is the engine that drives us to make things better for other people. And we've signed on to that. And there's nothing you can do to turn us around when it comes to that. Because we know what it's like to live a life of pain.
Mm. There's so many wonderful turning points in the history of this class you had. One of them is when you give up writing fragments, little particles of conversation or tryout phrases and decide, no, we're going to write a play. Then down the road, there's another transition when the play is taking shape and the question comes, okay, who wants to act in this play? Chris Hedges writes in the book, everyone in the class wanted a part. The nearly impenetrable emotional walls my students had erected over decades were crumbling. I was momentarily speechless. The class had agreed to become what one rarely dares to become in prison, vulnerable. Well, I said to the class, that's called courage. Does it sound familiar, Lawrence?
It absolutely does. Although Chris calls it courage, like for me, it was a way to tell a little bit of my story without having to paint the scarlet letter on myself that at one point in my life, I felt if people knew my truth, that it would paint on my chest. So for me, it was like, okay, I get to share this with people without having to say it's mine that I'm sharing.
What did the playwriting class do for you, Lawrence? What part of it is you now?
Not only did it give me a voice, but it really taught me the power of my voice. And one of the things that was said to me in one of my many long conversations, and it probably was from Boris, about, you know, our voices were suppressed not only by the system, but by ourselves and by our own fears for so many years. That now I live in a space and I occupy a realm where I refuse to be silenced about anything. And that is probably my biggest takeaway from being in this class and having my voice heard for the first time in my life. I'm a person that I was set to die in prison, right? But by this point, through my interaction with Chris and through some other people, I had just come to the point where I decided that if I'm going to die in prison, I'm going to be the first person to teach a class from in prison. I actually told Chris this once that, you know, if I had to die in prison, I wanted to be the first professor that lived in the prison and taught in the prison.
Mm. There's another great turning point, Chris Hedges, when this class comes to an end. And you write, I didn't imagine that these men, many bulked up by weightlifting and covered with crude prison tattoos, would stand in front of the class, their hands shaking slightly as they read their scenes, tears welling up in their eyes. Perhaps it worked only because it was organic, because none of it was planned or premeditated. We dreaded the end. There was, amid the excitement, a sense of mourning. Talk about it, Chris Hedges.
Well, we finished the play, and we couldn't perform it at the prison, so the great theologian James Cone and Cornel West came as our audience. It was a very moving night. Everyone practiced over and over their readings as if it was a Broadway opening. Both Cornel and James spoke to my students and the other students in the college program. And there was something magical, sacred about that. And I, you know, that last class, you don't cry in prison, but I couldn't hold it back in front of those students. Because I was walking out of that prison and they weren't. And Boris was so instrumental in this. We were just determined to make their song heard. These are people of such amazing talent and gifts. And because of the deep injustice that is mass incarceration, many of them will die in prison. And one of my students wrote a scene. It didn't end up being the play, but it was about being found dead in his cell, and the guards are just talking nonchalantly over his corpse as they shackle him, because under prison rules, even corpses that are taken out of the prison have to be shackled.
The transformation in the lives in this small book are unforgettable, and I want to believe they're real. Anybody want to speak on the general subject of transformation, the events, the people, the experiences, the time it takes to feel like a new person or like something real is emerging, finally? What do we conclude about transformation, Boris?
In this transformation, you're finally allowed to show a better version of yourself. You know, I've always been this person. The transformation is us transforming the world. I often let people know I can grow a ghetto faster than I can grow a garden. All you got to do is create the conditions for it. And then when you change the conditions, what you see is what you see right now. Me and Lawrence Bell have a quality of life. We could feed our families. But we were put under those extreme conditions at the early ages of 12, 13, 14. At 14 years old, I was worried about earning for my daily bread. I was already at a midlife crisis by 15. You change the conditions. And then you'll see the real individual shine through. So I haven't transformed. I'm just allowed to be myself now.
Lawrence Bell, what's your version of transformation?
I do share Boris's sentiment in terms of people being who they are when they're given the opportunity to be who they are. But for me, transformation takes on a little bit of a different meaning at certain points in my life. At 16 years old, I stood before a judge and he told me that I was irredeemable, that I was a despicable coward who never deserved to be amongst free people again. At 16 years old, for a crime that I'm alleged to have committed at 14 years old. So part of the reason that I was able to win my freedom with the help of Jennifer Saletti and the rest of the legal team is because I was able to demonstrate a transformation from a child into a man, not from a bad person into a good person, not from a criminal into a non-criminal, but from a child into a man, from an immature to a mature. I understand transformation, and I really appreciate the title of the book, Trauma and Transformation, right? Because a lot of times when people are considering transformation, they're not considering the fact that we have to transform how we deal with and interpret the traumas that we've been living for our whole lives before we can be our best selves. So for me, that's where transformation is rooted in accepting and learning how to deal with, conquer, overcome, or embrace, in some cases, the trauma that you've experienced in your life.
Chris Hedges, you triggered an incredibly interesting process in the playwriting, in the teaching, in the being there, attracting these extraordinary minds and hearts in Lawrence, in Boris. What's your take on transformation? What are we looking for still?
I think the transformation is the shattering of all of those walls, many of which Lawrence and Boris alluded to, that they had to build in order to survive. That transformation was a kind of flowering, where there's a numbness in a prison. You can't express grief. You can't cry. You can't express vulnerability because there's a whole subset within the prison that will prey upon you. And so you have this kind of concrete shell, in essence, and the shattering of that shell allows you to finally be who you are. You read the passage, the courage, and I meant it. It was courage because these people in that classroom were getting up and speaking about incredibly painful moments in their life in front of the rest of the class, which they'd never spoken about before. And what was interesting is that, if you remember, everyone would come up and read their scene, and they would finish, and everyone in the room would applaud. But it was a remarkable thing to witness, and courage is the right word, because they were in a space where outside that door, they weren't even referred to by their name. They were referred to by their number. And they walked into that space and dug deep within themselves to share with everyone in that room where they'd been, where they were, and where they were going. It was the power of that kind of intimacy and vulnerability, I think, made the whole experience, you know, organically religious.
Did anybody get hurt in the program?
No. I mean, people were hurt, you know, in terms of the stuff that they resurrected was so painful. I made an assignment where I said, let's write a dialogue with your mother, something you remember. And at the end of the class, Timmy, he came up and said, well, what if we're a product of rape? And I said, well, that's what you have to write, which he did. He'd never spoken about it before. And it's the phone call from the county jail, which is autobiographical. He's from Paterson, New Jersey. He's in a car with his half-brother, and there's a weapon found in the car. And if no one takes possession of it, everyone gets a weapons charge. And it wasn't his weapon, but he said, it's mine. And he calls his mother from the county jail, and he says, it doesn't matter, Ma. I was never supposed to be here anyway, and you have the son you love. And when we had that reading that final night with James Cone and Cornel West, immediately afterwards, he disappeared. And I said, where's Timmy? Where's Timmy? And they said, I think he's in the bathroom. And I found him huddled, shaking, sobbing in the corner of the bathroom. So yes, I think everyone was hurt, because what they were doing with is, in a very public way, in many cases, like such as that one, for the first time, expressing the hurt that in many ways defined their lives.
I agree that the hurt was, it was a healing process. The class was extremely therapeutic because we had begun to talk about things that we had never talked about. And, you know, this, in essence, to people who never really understood the value of therapy, it allowed it to run its course. And by allowing it to run its course, we were able to deal with what was coming next, right? Because it's like, you know, a lot of us have reached that point where the only thing that comes to mind is the straw that broke the bull's back, where you see some people explode over one small thing. It's because they've been carrying so much, right? So we were able to put it down in that classroom. And then we were able to walk out to the world, and we were able to walk out to the prison. And wherever we went, we weren't still carrying old baggage. We were taking on the new baggage, and we were able to shoulder it, to handle it. And it was a very, very therapeutic process for me, and I guess for most of the class.
Yeah. Give us a last word, Chris Hedges. What we do for an encore. What ordinary citizens can learn and maybe act on here. End it as you'd like.
There were people in my class who had committed a crime, but there were no criminals.
Meaning what?
The most criminal act is poverty, as George Bernard Shaw writes in Major Barbara. And we as a society have to invest in people, not in systems of control. Deindustrialization has created a society where the social bonds, as Durkheim writes, have been ruptured, destroyed for my students and for their families. And it is our responsibility to re-knit those social bonds by creating societies where people can live with dignity and self-worth. And John Paul II writes a great encyclical about the importance of work. And it's not just simply the exchange of labor for a wage, but it is about your place. And John Paul II even writes about its importance for holding together the family. And so with the ruthless neoliberal policies that have beset the country, the two major mechanisms of social control are militarized police and the largest prison system in the world. You know, as Abraham Joshua Heschel said, all are not guilty, but we're all responsible. And we're responsible for that because of what we have inflicted on people whose only crime was to be born poor in America.
Lawrence Bell, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the forum, and hopefully some people gain something positive from it.
Thank you, Boris Franklin.
Yes, I want to thank you as well. Thank you for providing the space for us to, you know, sing our song once again.
Thank you, Chris Hedges. We're devoted to the minister in you as well as the journalist. Keep both of those characters alive, please.
Thanks, Chris.
Chris Hedges' new book is called Our Class. Special thanks in this program to Boris Franklin and Lawrence Bell for their words, written and spoken. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath teaches our drama class. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source. Open Source is a proud member of Hub and Spoke, a collective of independent podcasts making some of the smartest audio you can find. This week, check out Iconography, a show about the icons, real and imagined, that define our sense of place. Host Charles Gustine visits the real Paddington Station in London as a way into a story about the fictional icon Paddington Bear, beloved by children of all generations. Listen at iconographypodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And learn more about the whole lineup of Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org.
Hub and Spoke. Audio Collective.